Welcome to the CBWC Theology for the Ordinary podcast on the Book of Revelation. I'm Cindy Emmons, and I'm here with Mark Dirksen and Ed Neufeld. Ed will lead us as we attempt to understand and apply the Book of Revelation in our own context. You're listening to episode 11 on Revelation chapters 17 to 19.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Cindy. We're going to start at Revelation 17 and go through 17 and 18 for the most part. Babylon, the prostitute. Pay your money and get your pleasure. That's the business of a prostitute, and that is the business of Babylon. We're going to see here that pleasure is wealth and luxury. It's not sexual pleasure. The pleasure of valuable possessions is the business of the prostitute. You see, there's always a beast and there's always a prostitute. There was a beast and a prostitute. They were both alive and well in Rome in the first century. The beast is basically anything that uses power and fear to separate us from the Lord. It coerces us into some kind of disobedience, and often people could not buy or sell. So there are economic implications, and we are afraid of the economic implications of following the Lord. And we're not sure what to do about that. That's the beast. Power and fear, and operate like a bully, where the consequences of being faithful to the Lord scare us. That's the beast, wherever it is. And the prostitute uses wealth and luxury to seduce us and deceive us. So right now in North America, the beast is relatively quiet. It's not gone, but for the most part, it's not a big problem. The beast is alive and well in other parts of the world right now, where it is a very dangerous thing to be a believer. Okay, that's where the beast is. But North America right now, I don't think the prostitute has ever been stronger. We live in the prostitute's backyard. Every mall is a brothel. And we all live in the prostitute's backyard. And for the most part, we are Laodicean enough to not know it. They had no idea. And that's sort of where we are. That's how this is going to end. Now let's go back to Babylon. The Bible introduces Babylon in Genesis 11 and Jerusalem in Genesis 14. Think of this, before we are one third of the way through Genesis, we've been told about both cities. And the last quarter of Revelation has lots to say about Babylon and Jerusalem. So in that sense, the Bible is truly a tale of two cities. And it's many, many times one or the other comes up in between. In Genesis 11, we read about the Tower of Babel, people united in a big project to be independent of God. In Hebrew, what we call Babel is Babylon. It is spelled in Hebrew exactly how the city of Babylon is always spelled. It is the Tower of Babylon. As people united to be independent of God. And do we see this around us? We sure do. And what comes out of their mouths? Babel. That's the point. Babel comes out of their mouths. In Genesis 14, Abraham was going home from a battle in which he had rescued his nephew Lot. And as Abraham traveled home, Melchizedek, king of Salem, came out to meet Abraham and gave him bread and wine, and he blessed Abraham. Besides being king of Salem, he was also a priest of God Most High. That's why he could bless Abraham. King of Salem. Salem is the last part of Jerusalem. So he was the king of the city that was called Salem at that time and eventually was called Jerusalem. There are one or two places in the Psalms where poetically Jerusalem is still called Salem there. It was a known word occasionally. And Melchizedek means king of righteousness. So he's the priest of God Most High, and he's the king of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is people united to serve God Most High. That's who it is. And from their mouths comes prayer and worship and blessing. That's what we see in Revelation. So these two cities are at the beginning of the Bible, and they both occur at the end, and that's not an accident. And in Revelation, they are both symbolic cities. In Genesis, they are both geographical cities. But in Revelation, they are both symbolic cities. But the spiritual attitude that we saw in Genesis, people united against God and what comes out of their mouths, and people united for God and what comes out of their mouths, that's what Revelation means for the most part by those cities. That's all background. Revelation, I think the whole book is trying to answer the question, what's really going on in the world? What explains the world we live in? There are a lot of explanations, but that's what John's first seven churches needed to hear. What is going on? They were in a terrible place because of persecution, and they can't make sense of it, and they feel abandoned by God, basically. The big beast, and also in some cases the prostitute, are defeating them and have them on the run, and they are miserable. What's going on? And so Revelation was written for persecuted churches, and it still works very well. I have heard from international students in classes that in other parts of the world where they don't know anything about dispensational or non-dispensational views of Scripture, Revelation makes a lot of sense to them. They don't know about apocalyptic, but they know the Bible, and they read this, and they can figure out what the basic message is. You don't have to know what each symbol stands for at all to get the message of Revelation. That's really what I would like to make clear. You don't have to know very many details. All you have to know is the ones that are actually spoken out clearly, that are described in Revelation. Then you can figure out the plot. So that's what's going on, and the prostitute is a big part of that. All right, I'm going to read chapter 17, Revelation 17, the first six verses. This is Babylon introduced. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, God's people, and the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. So how does Babylon fit into what we've already seen in Revelation? It's a part of the bowl judgments. One of the bowl judgment angels now shows these things to John. The seventh bowl said that the great city would be broken up. So Revelation 17 to 19 is an expanded view of the sixth and seventh bowl judgments. And I'm going to say that again. Revelation 17 to 19 is an expanded view of the sixth and seventh bowl judgments. She's a prostitute. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and those who live on the earth are intoxicated with the wine of her adultery. Only the kings can actually afford to have sex with the prostitute. So to commit adultery here means to actually afford to get into bed with her, means you can buy whatever you want regularly, and you live like that. Okay, that's called actually getting into bed with her. The rest of us can't do that. But we can afford to get feeling good with her adulterous wine. How does she look? She looks rich. She looks like a queen. The description does not try to make her sexually attractive. The Bible sometimes speaks to make women sexually attractive. That's not what it's doing here. This woman is rich, and everything a woman could want to wear to show off glory and wealth and be impressive, this prostitute owns and wears. And she is impressive to see, marvelous. And the cup she drinks is disgusting, putrid. She is drunk with the blood of the saints and those who are faithful to Jesus. the luxury system is a big problem to good Christians. It slaughters them to get forward, to go forward. She is filthy and bloodthirsty. She is a splendid-looking, putrid killer. So the description intends to show us that wealth and luxury are gross, disgusting, evil, and bloodthirsty, because people die to make that work. Okay? If somebody's going to have all they want, somebody else died because it costs something. You had to get that in some kind of a way. Blood is shed. To compare with Babylon, how does God's woman dress in Revelation 12? God's woman also looks like a queen, but she's got a crown of 12 stars, and she is clothed with the sun, and the moon is her footstool. That's the real woman. That's God's woman, clothed with the heavens. So that woman has to flee into the wilderness, in which God makes sure she survives. But beside God's woman, clothed with sun and crown of stars, and the moon as a footstool, the prostitute scarlet and purple fall a bit short. They look tacky. It's just bling, which I don't have a problem with bling. But anyway, in comparison with this, it's just on a completely different level. And we're trying to figure out here where our priorities are. Revelation is inviting us. So the rest of Revelation describes the Babylon, the prostitute, being destroyed. And I'm going to skip that and go to Revelation 18. Revelation 18, the seven funeral speeches, seven voices that speak at the great prostitute's funeral. Imagine seven people getting up to speak at a funeral. So we're going to go through each of this. There's lots of Babylon predictions in the Old Testament, and John in Revelation is using those things too, but I'm not going to talk about that very much. The first and seventh speakers are angels who announce what happened to Babylon. And the second voice is the actual voice of God. I'm not sure about the sixth voice, but the third and fourth and fifth speakers are the brokenhearted, those who are sad and discouraged at the death of the great prostitute. So it's from them who we find out who she is. Because, you see, when Babylon is destroyed, no human dies. Nobody dies. It's a system. Babylon's destroyed, no human dies. People stand off and mourn, but nobody dies. We'll talk more about that. So speech one, the angel announces that Babylon has fallen. This is the beginning of chapter 18. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illumined by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every impure spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable animal. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her luxuries." Okay, all the nations drink her wine. Everyone drinks the wine of her fornication and loses their way. Only the kings can afford to actually get into bed with her. The merchants, the buyers and the sellers all get rich from her luxuries. The nations get drunk and the kings go to bed and the merchants get rich. Who is she? Speech two, the Lord calls us. Come out of her, my people. I heard another voice from heaven say, come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, and so that you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Pour her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torment and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, I sit enthroned as queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn, and therefore, in one day her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire For mighty is the Lord God who judges her. So come out of her, my people. So you don't share her sins. I don't want you to receive her plagues. We're not called to come out of the beast. We're called not to submit. But God's people get way too close to the prostitute. Speech 3, the king's lament, chapter 18, verse 9. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, "Woe, woe to you, the great city, you mighty city of Babylon. In 1 hour, your doom has come." The kings fornicated with her and they shared her luxury. That's two ways of saying the same thing. To be immersed in wealth and luxury and to commit adultery with her are two ways of saying the same thing. In the ancient world, kings were obscenely wealthy and almost nobody else. Now, often the political leaders are not the most wealthy, although often they are very wealthy. But we certainly have those for whom there's no limit to anything their eye can see or heart desire they can get for themselves. So in those days, that was kings, and they lived like that. And nowadays, it's other people. But fornication and sharing luxury are the same thing. And they're terrified because you were so great and so mighty, and 1 hour, you were gone. See, if we have power and money, we feel secure. We're actually okay even if God ignores us because we have money and power. We can be independent. It is a big, evil lie. It will all be gone in 1 hour. In the sower and the seed parable, the thorns that choke good plants are the cares of life and the deceitfulness of wealth. When things go well economically, I feel safe. I just do. And when things look shaky, I don't feel safe. When things look shaky economically, I don't feel safe. That's the lie. That's it right there. It's close to home. And that's the deceitfulness of wealth. It's a very destructive thing. So we just need to call it what it is and realize that it's a big problem to God. Speech 4, the merchant's lament. Wow, this is a long one. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their stuff anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen. I'm not going to read all this stuff. Oh, at the end, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and humans and bodies is basically what it says. Human bodies. Humans sold as slaves. It's really crass. That's part of it. They will say, let's read what they say. The fruit you longed for is gone from you. I'm picking it up at chapter 18, verse 14. All your luxury and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, "Woe to you, the great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin." This is the longest speech at the funeral. It is at the center of the seven. It is important. Why do the merchants weep and mourn? Because no one buys their stuff. It is that simple. All these stores are full. The warehouses are full. The stores are full. Nobody's buying it. Nobody's buying it. And do you notice about this long list of cargoes that they bring? It's all luxury stuff. Simple, plain clothes and food are not on this list. This is all stuff that ordinary people don't have and the people don't need. They are not the basics of life, ordinary food and clothing and shelter. 1 Timothy 6 says, if we have food and clothing and shelter, with this we will be content. Godliness with contentment is a great gain. It's a great profit. Godliness plus contentment equals great profit. No, that's not the kind of profit we want. Okay? I want my mutual funds to show a profit. But godliness with contentment is a great profit. So Babylon, the prostitute, is an economic system based on luxury, things that are beautiful and expensive. It's based on what people want, not what they need. The real buying and selling is luxuries, not essentials. This is actually scary. When we buy something, we experience pleasure. It feels good to buy something and to own it. For a little while, it feels good. Now we can shop from home on Amazon. Shipping is free. They already got your credit card. Click, click, and it's in the mail. We just drank some of the wine of our fornication and got a little drunk, and it felt good. We know far too much about this. I know far too much about this. The kings are immensely wealthy. They can buy what they want. That's called getting into bed with her. They can fornicate. That's real expensive. The rest of us aren't. We still run behind her with our tongues hanging out. That's called drinking the maddening wine of her adultery. People, this economic system here and now is in full force. We live in her backyard. All our advertising is trying to create a desire and a need for something we don't need. They're not talking about stuff we need. They're talking about stuff we don't need, but if they do a good job, we'll buy it. Like, how is that not this? I am convinced that if everybody in North America suddenly stopped buying what we want, only bought what we need, our economy would be trashed in 2 weeks. There'd be nothing else in the news. Because our whole system, the whole advertising built around stuff that almost none of it do we need. Jesus saw money and possessions as his strongest competition for our minds and souls. He said more about wealth and possessions than about love. He thought wealth and prosperity were dangerous. It's very hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven, he said, nearly impossible. We don't think it's dangerous. We're just quietly relieved. There's no sense of danger. See, this is the Laodicean church. The Laodicean church, when God says, come out of her, my people, that's the Laodicean church. I am about to spit you out of my mouth. You say, I am rich. I have acquired wealth. I don't need a thing. That's exactly how it works. You don't realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. They were intoxicated with the prostitute's wine. They had it all and nothing that counted, and he wanted to spit them out. It gives me the creeps, actually. Wealthy people feel secure, and they are not. Speech 5, the sailor's lament. Ancient sailors were transporters, like our truckers. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors, all who earn their living from the sea, will stand off. Every trucking company owner and every trucker and all who learn their living from transportation will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this great city? They will throw dust on their heads and weeping and mourning will cry out, woe to you, great city, where all who had ships on the sea and trucks on the highway became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour, she has been wrought to ruin. The sailor's last words, ruined in 1 hour. The money stuff is a myth. Speech 6. God tells his people to celebrate. Rejoice over her, you heavens. Rejoice, you people of God. Rejoice, apostles and prophets, for God has judged for you against her. What should God's people do when they see the smoke of her burning? Rejoice, celebrate, praise, thank God. He has answered the prayers of his people for justice. For God's people, the prostitute's destruction is a day of delight. That's not necessarily what I feel by the time I've got to that part, but that's what God thinks it is. Babylon will never be rebuilt. That is the last voice, speech 7. A mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, pipers and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No worker of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of the bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's important people. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of prophets and saints and all who've been slaughtered on the earth. Now, when the economy takes a dive, professionals call that a correction. And you know, it will recover. And there have been some bad ones, and there's always some kind of recovery. But the point of a speech seven is there's no recovery this time. It's just over. And the more of our lives we have invested in that, the worse off. So let's pull this together. She sells pleasure, and that's her business. I've said this often enough. Most of us aren't wealthy, but we can run after her with our tongues hanging out. The prostitute is an economic system based on the pleasure of having what we want, things we like, rather than the basics. Watch advertising through the eyes of Revelation 17 and 18. It's pretty obvious they're trying to create a desire for something we didn't know we needed, didn't have an interest in it, except we saw a picture of it there and an attractive person telling us what a good idea this is. And we do not see how deeply evil this system is, how offensive to God, how dangerous to God's people. This we do not see. Revelation wants to help us. God blessed Israel with prosperity at different times. In the Old Testament, material blessing was so that people could have enough food and clothing and they could live in peace, not worrying about enemies and starvation. The purpose of God's blessing was not so people would accumulate more and more clothes, houses, carriages, expensive things. The purpose of God's material blessing was that people could enjoy God and life and each other without worrying about having enough. Not to get more things, but to enjoy God and life. Enjoying the things was never on the map. That's not what they enjoyed in times of prosperity. That was not the ideal. You were supposed to enjoy life and worship and each other and the world. That's why you had things. On the whole, we already know quite a bit of this. We know that Christ calls us to live simply and generously and be content. You know, you all knew that before today. And in certain ways, more or less, we do seek to live this out. But let's hear the Lord's call again, because we live in the prostitute's backyard. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, and so you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. 1 Timothy 6 is one of my favorites. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Think of that. God provides for our enjoyment. Command them to do good and to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. And this way they'll lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Amen.
My first question for you, Ed, is one of the great dangers to faith in the West is that we've been inoculated against the perceived dangers of the pursuit of wealth. So how do our churches go about discipling folks about these dangers?
The elders need to be examples to the flock, including this. I read some advice long before I was a pastor. I was quite young. This person said, it's in a book, an article, he's talking to pastors. He said, preach on stewardship every year. Have a series, one to three sermons on stewardship every year from Scripture, and make them pretty direct. And when you preach about stewardship, have nothing to do with the budget. There's nothing to do with whether your church has lots of money or not enough. Stewardship is entirely between a worshiper and God. This is an act of faithfulness to God. We give to God because he calls us to, and it is an act of love and faithfulness to him. And what he does with the money is largely secondary. So I'm a big fan of sharing with each other, but it is primarily an act of worship. And you don't preach about giving because the budget is low, and you don't stop when the budget is good. Preach about giving because it's part of being faithful to the Lord. In the same way, you know, we would talk about a sexual purity or not stealing or not lying or being kind when people are grumpy to us and so on. It's just part of a basic discipline of following the Lord. I've done that. I was a young guy and it made sense to me. One of those lucky moments, right? Somebody said it right. And God says, Edmund, pay attention. You could use this. So for 32 years, we have talked about that. And the budget has not come up ever in a sermon like that. Not once. So I don't really know how to fix this, Mark. You want to know how to fix this? It's a really big problem. And when you live like this, I'm not sure. So we can call. And I have used this text. I have used this text. That I preach from Genesis, anywhere from Genesis to this text when I talk about giving. I'll tell you something else. Give as generously as you can convince yourself to give. And be in a decent frame of mind about it. Give as much as you can, you know, sort of get away with. And I'll tell you that I give in self-defense. I give because I'm afraid of the prostitute. And I give, and every time I put money in the offering, I am walking out of the prostitute's backyard and into the temple. And I give because that's the only way to get out of her backyard that I know of, is to actually give some of your finances so that you're not buying luxuries and you could buy her stuff. No, this is going to go to the real God. And so as many times as you can walk across that street, that's how I do it. So I give in self-defense because I am immensely attracted by this prostitute and I don't trust myself and I have all the bad instincts and I know too much about the Bible and I know that this is bad news for me. So I don't know how to make it go away, except I preach like this and I've increased in self-defense because I'm not pleased with myself. And I'm fortunate to have a wife who would give more than I give, so she would give it all away in a moment. I don't have more ideas, but those are the kind of things that I have done. So talk pointedly and practice it.
And related, I guess, but how do we take inventory of our own lives from time to time to evaluate if we've drank Babylon's wine?
You know, this puts a different flavor on the pleasure of buying something. Maybe you don't know about that pleasure, but I do. And I'm like that. And okay, so it makes you say, you know, I'll wait a little longer before I do that. It's not complicated. I have no magic about this. But just call it what it is. At least we could start by calling it what it is. So I call it what it is, not all the time. but I think about, you know, what is the difference between need and want and where do I feel safe and all of that stuff. So it's very complicated. And my mind is contaminated. There's nobody in North America hardly that isn't contaminated by this. But if there are, I'm not one of them. When I was a young Christian, college age, there were a few teachers who preached the simple life and the stern teachings of Jesus about possessions and wealth. And they preached that very directly to us. Then we were all excited to follow Jesus. Good, they said. This is how it looks. This is how it works. And they talked about the rich young ruler and the guy who built bigger barns and these different stories and so on. And it made a big impact on me. And I thought, you know, that is what Jesus said. I didn't know it, but it is what he said. And so there were a group of us that resonated with this. You know, you don't know when you're young how much it's actually going to cost to be poor all your life. I was ready when I was 20 to be poor all my life. When I was 40, I was still quite poor, and I didn't like it anymore. So, however, that was very good for me, what those people did. And my wife was also in that larger circle at that time. We were not together then, but she was in that larger circle and influenced by this as well. The Sermon on the Mount kind of teaching. And why do you worry about clothes? And why do you worry about food? And wow, what a way to live. Could you actually live like that? So we were young enough to believe that. It was a big call in me at that time. There's a minimalist movement. I've got kids in that, and they are just sick and tired of this prostitute. And they're not all Christians. They're just tired of it. What a gross way to live. And us rich guys think, well, they figured this out all by themselves. Anyway, good for them. So I like that. There's something about the image of God in the people who want to live like that, whether they follow the Lord or not. It's a very good thing. So I would, you know, preach the discern call, and the young people will actually embrace it more fully in many cases than the older ones.
How do we know when part of this world's economic system is actually good? For example, like a pension plan for pastors, in my mind, is a helpful piece. It's kind of like pastoral care, but is that evidence that we've drank the wine?
I don't know about that. I have had questions about that myself. But as it stands, if I have means to lay aside so that I could feed and clothe myself, then I'm going to do that. And not at the expense of generous giving. It's not going to be the priority. I will try to get both done and have sort of how I have lived. But I don't think that's wrong. Farmers work hard, and when they sell their farm, when they retire, they have a huge amount of money. So they buy a fifth wheel and all of that and go, well, fine, I don't care. Go on a cruise. Let's not judge. Because sometimes the people who spend lavishly on themselves have also been immensely generous their whole lives. Immensely. There's a lot of self-righteousness in this business, and let's not do that either. I've been gone a little ways down that road, and I'm really sorry I ever did. So, because there are people who spend a lot on themselves, and they give a lot of money away, and I'm not sure God's any more pleased with me than them. Quite possibly less so. So,
I just like how honest you are, Ed, about things. I just relate to you and the way you describe things.
When I go car shopping, I'm not looking for the base model anymore. And, you know, when I took on this job, I said to Mary, we're going to buy Bothwell cheese now.
The Lord's going to forgive you for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the Lord understands that. Yeah.
Mark knows this about us. We've had like 12 cars. They keep getting run over, like totaled. It's just how that happens. Once you get to the place where you realize that cars don't really matter and we can drive this old one and share this one and figure it out together, then all of a sudden God just kind of plunks things in your lap. But I find that really interesting. And it's not just in relation to cars. It's like lots of areas. Like mm-hmm. It's just so interesting that way.
My story has been like that too, our story. I didn't try to do anything different, but it was lean for quite a while, and then it wasn't anymore. And I have no idea how that happened. He's generous. He is certainly generous.
Yeah.
Thing is, I think that, I mean, I would like to be wealthy. If I'm full disclosure, I'd like to be wealthy so that I could give it away.
Would it spoil some great eternal plan if you made me a wealthy man?
You heard?
that's the beginning of Fiddler on the Roof, right?
Yeah,
have you listened to Fiddler on the Roof?
Yeah.
It's a very good question.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I wonder if our heart would change. The guy I've gotten used to living simply, what would happen if all of a sudden a bunch of money came our way? I don't know if I would like the person I became. I'm not sure.
I don't need any more than I got. It's been a mental discipline, and there's lots of kindness from the Holy Spirit in this. Set yourselves to living that way. He pays attention and helps us make peace with where we are. So that's also going on.
You know, I'm not always a big fan of celebrities, but I do take notice when celebrities are deliberate about not leaving their fortunes to their kids. I find that to be very interesting.
Okay, I don't like interesting. See what you mean.
I think the celebrity themselves has figured out that there's more to life than all these riches at my fingertips. And I want my kid to learn something. So, I mean, and with wealth comes a lot of different issues, right? So, I mean, like our church is in a wealthy neighborhood, but there's a lot of drug abuse in the church's neighborhood, right? There's lots of things there that wealth brings that we're not thinking about.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it depends how old you are when you get your wealth, I guess. But you give a lot to a young person, it doesn't help. I had ways to make money, and I never have lived in poverty, but not very much came like that. Just enough to make you grateful for people. Yeah, that's good. My kids, once in a while, need help. My parents did that for me, and I want to do that. So sometimes I can help, and I enjoy that. And it's not enough that they don't have to work, but it's enough to get them over a hard place. And I'm really pleased to be able to do that.
Thanks for joining us. Our next episode will be on Revelation chapter 20.